Thanks for clicking on and tuning into this audiobook presentation presented by The Bill Murphy Show. What follows is the first in a series of the chapters in podcast or podcast form, reading the words of the 2015 book written by my dad, Bill Murphy Sr., entitled Three Up on 17, a collection of chip shots and cheap shots. With Father's Day fast approaching, we thought it would be appropriate to share with you these chapters to give you an idea of how light, humorous, and touching this story can be. Suitable for golf enthusiasts and novices alike, this book shares some very humorous stories from on the golf course and off the golf course, and can be appreciated by those well-versed in the sport and not so well-versed in the sport, and is especially appealing to anyone who had even a moment's experience with my dad's wonderful dry sense of humor. Available now at Amazon.com and other book outlets. We think you'll agree after hearing just some of this, you'll want to share 3 Up on 17 with your father this coming Father's Day. Thanks again for tuning in, and we begin now with Chapter 1, Rules. 3 Up on 17 by Bill Murphy. I have often wondered if there is a second page to the official rules of bowling. If there is, then I cannot imagine what it might cover. The 2009 version of the Rules of Golf, as set forth and published by the United States Golf Association in conjunction with the Royal and Ancient Blokes in Scotland, is a fun-packed 170 pages, covering 34 rules with appendices on equipment, deportment, formats, and God knows what. The Decisions book is over 800 pages of interpretation of the previously mentioned 34 rules. Aren't we special? I am, in fact, a USGA rules official. That does not mean I have a diploma on my wall or that I carry a badge and credentials. What it does mean is I have attended the 4-day workshops conducted by the USGA and the PGA. It further means I took the tests at the completion of said workshops to determine whether or not I had actually learned anything or, as is quite often the case, came away even more confused. I did manage to absorb the fine points of all 34 rules and have spent the past 10 years applying that vast knowledge as a rules official at countless professional mini-tours and amateur events throughout Florida. My motivation to pursue this road came about as a result of so many years of playing the game, just a tad outside the confines that the strict rules allow. I am not talking about cheating, kicking it, or reaching in my pocket in the deep woods and screaming, "Found it!" I am referring to the basic, seemingly inconsequential procedures I contend we all overlook during each and every round. When I first began to organize and score dogfights and skins games at a public facility, I realized we had more issues each week. With a little bit of cash on the line, it seemed that folks started to pay closer attention. Going back to the previous statement about having played outside the strict confines, I submit that you should not be shocked by such an admission of guilt on my part. And before you rush to judgment, allow me to ask the following. During the course of the last round of golf you completed with three other fellow athletes, how many times did you or another player do one or more of the following things? 1. Play the round with more than 14 clubs. 2. Put a new ball in play that was of a different brand or type. 3. Fail to announce you were playing a provisional. 4. Tap down spike marks on the intended line of putt. 5. Brush away impediments with a hat or towel. 6. Take 2 club lengths of relief, as opposed to 1. 7. Putt with a ball other than the one you began the hole with. 8. Ask for advice from someone other than your partner or caddy. 9. Drop a ball in a way other than prescribed in Rule 20. 10. Improve a lie. The above are trivial infractions and usually of little or no consequence to the outcome of a round or a match. However, they are infractions, and they can lead to habits that lead to an even more liberal attitude toward the rules in general. Bullshit, you say. Let us play the game the way we want. Hold on, this is not a sermon. The only difference between me and some drunk at the end of the bar is I can't be interrupted. If you intend to spend your time on the course as a chance to bond with nature, then do so. Kick the ball. Throw it. Write a letter to the USGA and tell them where to stick their pretty little book. If, on the other hand, you intend to compete and improve, then I suggest the following course of action. If you have a regular group and you feel you fall into this outside the confines category, try taking your next outing and treating it as an experiment. Play it strictly by the book, and don't forget to include holing every putt. I've got a lithograph likeness of Ben Franklin that says you will never go back to the old way. Do not, however, let it slow down your pace of play. Christ, don't slow down. Pick it up if it gets ugly. In match play, you just lose the hole, so lose it quickly and get to the next tee. Golf House. The headquarters for the USGA is located in Far Hills, New Jersey, which is about a 40-minute drive west of New York City. The stark change of scenery as you exit I-80 and approach the facility is a dramatic change from the concrete jungle of Manhattan. It is a sprawling, rural community with two-lane country roads winding past farms and multi-acre estates. As you make your way up the quarter-mile driveway to the main building, you would no doubt be distracted by at least a few dozen deer taking advantage of the foliage that abounds the campus. On my initial visit, I was struck with a feeling of awe I almost resented. This is not a holy shrine, I thought, so why has this feeling of overwhelming reverence come over me? I had chosen this site for my first workshop on the rules and was arriving on a Sunday afternoon for a four-day session. As I entered the front door, I resisted a sudden and somewhat instinctive urge to genuflect before the large oil paintings of Bobby Jones and Walter Hagen. Get a hold of yourself, I thought. The workshops are conducted at many sites throughout the country, and for a minute I wished I had chosen one that would have prevented the feeling of inferiority. I needed a slap. Thank God I was wearing the navy blazer and the red striped tie against the button-down blue Oxford dress shirt. Thank God! I looked exactly like the other 60 folks surrounding the registration desk. For a second, I thought I was back in Catholic school. The workshop was more than informative and conducted in an extremely professional and orderly fashion. There were a number of instructors, each of which had credentials up the wazoo. The classroom facility itself would rival the War College at the Pentagon, considering the visual arts aids and laser pointers. The final exam was far more difficult than I expected, albeit laced with hypothetical situations that, in reality, had no chance of happening in the real world. The nuts and bolts of golf rules had been absorbed, and I certainly left with a feeling of confidence I could deal with any future rules situation as it might occur. I had chosen Golf House as my workshop site due to both the proximity of my younger son's home in West Orange and the location of the assisted living home on the Jersey Shore where my 96-year-old mother was residing at the time. My visit with her at the completion of the course would prove to put the aforementioned reverence for the USGA and their red brick antebellum headquarters into proper perspective. 4 days, 34 rules, and a 4-hour test later, I headed to the shore. Except for a small degree of dementia, Mom was fairly sharp and was her usual feisty self. When I explained that my reason for being in the area had to do with a school, she looked a bit confused. "Good Lord, you haven't finished school yet? I was 60 years old." I reassured her about the school thing and went on to explain the 4-day rules workshop. 4 days to learn the rules of golf?" she remarked with disbelief. "Why, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. You hit, go find it, and hit it again. What a waste of time." As I left her that afternoon, I wished I could return to Far Hills and somehow engrave her words in stone above that hollowed entrance. Spike marks. I would be remiss in not covering this subject right here and now. The rule that covers spike marks on the green is clearly void of the term spike marks. Rule 16-1 explains what you may do on the green and does not say you may tap down spike marks. Therefore, you may not. Probably no rule has been more abused and therefore more discussed than this one. And the general consensus among casual, non-competitive players is that it is a bullshit rule and not within the spirit of the game. In truth, there are PGA Tour players who are not fully on board with the rule. The very few accusatory incidents that have occurred have all had to do with this subject. Was it a ball mark or a spike mark, and who is to say after the fact? I had occasion back in the mid-1990s to play the first of many rounds with Eric Schwarz, who was then, and still is, the tour caddy for Corey Pavin. The stakes were long-neck Miller Lights, which are deeply cherished by Big E, as well as my own damn self. Through some stroke of luck, I was faced with a 20-foot birdie putt on the first hole and was giving it the tour look, complete with stroll and plumb bob. After one last obnoxious walk to the hole, I made my way back to the ball and tapped down two spike marks along the way. The lad went postal. What the fuck was that? His hands were in the air. I went on to explain about Bermuda greens in Florida and how everybody does it and how much play the course had received that day. I was eloquent, but he was not amused. I missed the putt. Eric came out ahead in the long neck department. Eric is a close friend of my oldest son, and the very reason for Eric's visit at the time was that Corey Pavin, as well as other tour players, was skipping the Florida swing, as it's called, due in part to the condition of Florida greens in the winter. I stopped fixing spike marks until my next $10 Nassau, and I watched my opponents walk across the green like blind men with red and white striped canes. Do not look for this rule to change in your lifetime. I offer you this precedent. Imagine the condition of the putting surface for a 15-foot putt that faced the shepherds in Scotland when they started this whole thing 500 years ago. Spike marks, you think? The beginnings. After careful research, the golf historians have agreed not to agree on where or by whom this glorious game came about. Along with the Scots, there are claims from the Dutch, the French, and even the Italians, all having what they refer to as bona fide proof of the origin. Where they do agree to agree is that the foothold lies with the Scots somewhere in the mid-15th century. I am not alone in my belief of the popular theory that it started with the shepherds beating a ball of dried sheep dung from brae to brae with their crooks. That just seems perfectly sensible to me, not to mention romantic. What we do know for historical fact is that word of the game spread enough for both King James III in 1470 and King James IV in 1491 to ban the game via two separate edicts. It seems that the knights, in their brave and fearless armies, were too busy playing golf, soon to be known as golf, and neglecting to keep a watchful eye on the border to the south so as to prevent an invasion by the bloody British. Two important facts to note here are that Jimmy number 4 eventually turned into the first golf junkie and that the Scottish and British thrones merged, presumably because the Ryder Cup was going to be played there in the 20th century and they did not want to fuck that whole deal up with all its TV revenue and exposure. But I digress. It appears that for a couple of hundred years, the game was self-policed. During that period, the rules were set up and agreed to prior to the match, with any such rules being inequity. Interestingly enough, the term inequity is now the sole subject of Rule 1-4 in our current rulebook. It was not until 1744, however, that a formal set of rules was adopted by a group who called themselves the Honorable Company of Edinburgh Golfers, soon to be known as the St. Andrew Society, who would refine the rules to include stroke play. Subsequently, this group of gentlemen would evolve into what we now know as the Royal and Ancient. If you already know why there are 18 holes in a golf course, or for that matter don't care, then you may want to skip this paragraph. For those of you that hung in there, well, you might be disappointed to learn that the real reason has nothing to do with the amount of time needed to consume a bottle of scotch. Quite simply, the original links at St. Andrews consisted of 11 holes out and 11 holes in, for a total of 22. At some point, it was determined that two holes on each side were just too damn short, and it was decided to merge them with other holes. They were then satisfied that 18 would be the standard for all courses. Of significance here was that, as the ruling body, the RNA issued a formal notice to all member clubs that they needed to adjust their courses to meet the standard of 18. At that point, there were clubs with as few as 6 and as many as 20 holes. I mentioned the possible disappointment of some of you in learning that the bottle of scotch played no part in golf course design. No one could have been more disappointed than a good friend and golf companion of mine. A day or two after my research into the matter, I ran into him at a local adult beverage establishment. As I sat down, he began a rather derogatory diatribe on the size of then-Senator Hillary Clinton's lower torso. Ah, geez, I thought I definitely don't want to go down that road, at least not yet. I stopped him mid-curse and mentioned the 18-hole thing. His eyes widened and the senator's anatomy left the agenda board. "It's the Scotch thing, isn't it?" He was livid. As gently as possible, I explained how it was not, in fact, the Scotch thing. I somehow had escaped the task of telling my children about Santa Claus, but right then, I knew what it would have been like. He was quiet and deeply saddened, and at that point I wished I had stayed with the whole HRC thing. He had been so happy with that. I opted for an early exit, and as I stood to leave, he suddenly came out of his funk. "Wait a second," he said with his finger raised. "I'll bet you this. I'll bet you that the hole in the green is exactly the size of a bottom of a bottle of scotch. I'll bet you. Yeah, you go look that up in your damn history book." "I think you might be right," I said. He needed a hug. "Well, guess what, boys and girls? Go try it. Grab a quart bottle of scotch and a sharp box cutter. Put the bottle on the living room carpet and cut around the circumference. What you will get is a perfect circle suspiciously close to 4 1/4 inches. Not to mention a great target for practice putting and possible eviction notice. No further research necessary." In the early 1890s, there arose a need for a governing body for the game of golf in America. The sport was spiking in popularity. If not with the common folk, then certainly with those of means. The USGA was formed to oversee the first playing of both the US Open and the US Amateur in Newport in 1894. That body remains today as the Oval Office of Golf for the United States and works in concert with the RNA on all matters regarding the rules. They meet every 2 years to discuss changes, and we should all take pride in our game that they are reluctant to make changes. The formal set of 13 rules that were written in 1744 remains intact at this writing, with only minor changes, mostly in the area of language. Not only as a rules official, but also as a player, I am elated when reading the original rule and comparing it to the same rule as it is written today. Allow me to share two examples with you. Rule 5 of the original 13 from 1744 reads, "If your ball comes among water or any watery filth, you are at the liberty to take out your ball and bringing it behind the hazard and teeing it, you may play it with any club and allow your adversary a stroke for so getting out your ball." With the exception of the teeing thing, this is Rule 26. As for the allowance of the stroke to the adversary, there was no stroke play at the time, and the stroke applied to the status of the hole in match play. Rule 9 of the original 13 reads, "No man at holing his ball is allowed to mark his way to the hole with his club or anything else." This is Rule 16-1. It is all about tapping down spike marks and remains intact some 270 years later. Meanwhile, I played some hoops in high school, and I'm convinced that, within 5 years, dribbling will not be required. The Helpline. At my initial workshop, I did become more knowledgeable on the rules and managed to mediate most, if not all, controversies as they arose. It was not until after the workshop in Far Hills that I became aware of yet another safety net in the event of an unresolved dispute. One can simply call the USGA and ask for the rules department. Someone, an actual live person, will answer your question. No menu, no press one for English, no bullshit about how important the call is to them and how someone will be with you moment friggin'-tarily. It is not a 24/7 service and is available only during business hours. And you'd better not call during open week. The place is deserted. This is indeed a useful safety net for anyone faced with an unusual rules dilemma. The key word here is unusual. It took a few calls for me to learn an important lesson when using this avenue of assistance. Do not give them your name. They will not ask, but if they do, then make one up. But do not use your own. Why? I'll tell you why. The person you speak with not only knows the rules, but his preschool children know the rules by number and subsection. He, or as is often the case, she, will not only give you the answer, but will in all likelihood do so without opening their book. Picture it. You've spent hours leafing through an entire 800 pages of the decision book. You've discussed it with 6 different people, and you are absolutely expecting the dude or dudess at the USGA to say, "Whoa, that's a good one." Not gonna happen. You will be quoted the rule, and it will be so simple that you will be left with a look on your face that would make a deer in the headlights look brilliant. "Anything else we can help you with today?" will be the next thing you hear, to which you will reply, "Nope, thanks for your help. I thought that was the rule, but I needed to be sure," which, by the way, is a bullshit answer. You had no clue. That's why you called. Don't misunderstand me here. Those folks are terrific, and I thank them for not only being there, but for their courtesy and patience. They simply cannot help themselves. They know the rules, and their quick and precise answers will leave you with the feeling of being spoken down to, not unlike the manner of your third-grade nun. Remember, don't give them your real name.